Well, thanks for joining us for the Brothers Grimm. Welcome back. It's good to be back. How are y'all doing?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Just work's going good. Getting back in the swing of things.
I don't know if y'all know this, but Jeremy and Brian actually work together.
We do.
They see each other a lot more than Jeremy and I, or Brian and I see each other.
Yeah, so brothers actually don't get to see each other as much.
Yeah, I mean, we try to see you, but you just never, you know, we're really big about going to lunch, like, pretty much every day, and...
That's not pretty much every day. Y'all go to lunch every day.
Yeah. Well, Joey used to go to lunch with us.
I used to. True. I got busy.
Yeah.
No, you allowed your assistant to start scheduling meetings at 1 p.m.
Yeah, that's
kind of your She's your fault. Assistant. Just tell her don't schedule anything until 2, and then you can come meet with us.
But you know, I don't mind it. It's fine. It's fine. I do miss y'all, though. I wish I could come to lunch more often.
It's true. We went and had sushi today.
Oh, gosh. See, I'm glad
we did. It was great.
No, I'm not a sushi fan.
Well, I didn't eat sushi. I had hibachi, but...
See, I don't understand why you don't like sushi.
Well, I just don't really like raw fish of really any kind. Mm. I don't mind, like, California rolls. Those are pretty good. And I'll do a tempura.
Yeah, but California roll's not really real sushi.
It's sushi enough, Brian. Mm.
It is. It's the starter sushi. It's starter like the gateway sushi.
It's fine. It's good.
It is the gateway sushi.
You can't really go wrong with a little avocado, little crab, right?
See, it's not even really crab. It's imitation crab.
See, my favorite is the Philly roll, which is smoked tuna or tuna, and then cream cheese.
Oh, God.
Love cream cheese.
Smoked tuna and cream cheese?
Yeah. Well, really, it's more of just raw tuna. It's not necessarily smoked.
That sounds terrible.
Let me tell you about these guys. They're talking about the other day smoked salmon for breakfast.
Ew.
Yeah.
That's gross.
You've never had that? Like, so on a bagel, you have just a normal bagel, cream cheese, smoked salmon, and then capers on top? Bro.
That sounds disgusting.
It's incredible.
That sounds like getting the Filet-O-Fish on a biscuit. I'm sorry. That sounds gross.
On a biscuit.
You cannot compare this to Filet-O-Fish.
I think he just did.
But you can't. Like,
I absolutely just did.
You have got to try it before you can knock it.
What's a weird thing that you eat?
I mean, it's not really that weird. I love tuna fish.
See, I hate tuna fish as well.
I love a good tuna fish sandwich or maybe like a tuna sub.
Dude, we go to Jersey Mike's and all that man can talk about. And he's like, tuna fish. Love the tuna fish.
That is disgusting.
It's tuna, they make it fresh on the can. They make it fresh on the premises.
You just said the terms fresh out of the can. And that just right there is like, yeah. It's fish out of a can. I really like seafood. I know it sounds like I don't. I just don't like raw fish and I don't like tuna fish.
What's with the raw fish? Is it like the texture? Like, what about raw fish that you don't like?
It's absolutely a texture thing.
Okay.
It's a little too slimy. I had oysters for the first time.
Okay.
Raw?
On our beach trip this past summer. No, not raw. I got them Rockefeller. Well, I had one that was Rockefeller, and that was really good. I really liked that. And then my wife, she had raw oysters, and I had one. And it almost came back.
I'm proud you at least tried it.
Never again.
How do you eat it? Do you just eat it out of the shell, or do you like?
I slurped it out of the shell like you're supposed to, right?
For your first time, it's fine. For me, I love raw oysters, but what I do is I put them on a saltine, okay, and I'll get either some horseradish or like hot sauce. Uh-huh. Put a little hot sauce on it, eat it, and the texture of the cracker helps with the sliminess of the oyster.
I might have chased the oyster with a cracker.
Yeah, you should eat it together. It'd be a lot better.
It was disgusting. It almost came back up.
The only other weird thing that I eat is my mom makes this amazing macaroni and cheese and hamburger meat.
Yes, it's the worst thing in the world.
It is not. Shut your dirty mouth.
You would think, okay, let's combine macaroni and cheese and hamburger meat. And you think, oh, those are two relatively flavorful things. They should have equally full flavor. No, that's absolutely wrong. You combine them and they like negate each other's flavors out. And it becomes this bland, mushy mess.
No, he is lying. It is delicious. If I was on death row, that would have to be part of my last meal.
I mean, that's basically just beef stroganoff.
No.
What you just described.
No, she makes it with the shells and cheese, the Velveeta shells and cheese, so the meat gets into the shell. It's the best thing in the world.
It's basically beef stroganoff, but replace the stroganoff sauce with cheese.
Yeah.
Like the pouch cheese. And it's Velveeta shells and cheese.
It's delicious.
And it's gross.
It's my favorite thing in the world.
I mean, if you can season it right, like use the proper seasonings for your ground beef and for your macaroni, it could be good.
She just browns the meat.
She didn't put like any salt, pepper, or nothing on it?
Nah, man.
Well, that's so why it didn't taste good.
It tastes delicious.
Well, I also know what you eat on a daily basis, so.
Listen, man, don't hate.
I don't think I eat anything weird. I think I have a very picky palate.
Hey, go, Brian, who's pickier, me or Joey?
That's a hard one, because Jeremy will like turn his nose up at certain types of food.
Truth.
And like give our lunch options, like we come up with like 8 different options. Jeremy is okay with 2 of them, maybe. Joey, he's more specific on how you like eat your food, or like you don't like your food touching and just stuff like that.
He's true. I like to eat one thing at a time.
Yeah. Like you'll go in and you'll either eat like a Chick-fil-A. You eat your sandwich first or your fries first.
Yeah.
And then you'll eat your other thing.
That's right.
For me, I got to have all the different flavors and textures at one time.
Now, see, when it comes to fast food, though, like I feel like you have to eat fries first because they get cold as quickest.
I just eat everything together.
If you just like potatoes and you like fries, then you can eat them cold, hot, doesn't matter.
Now, tell our listeners. Educate our listeners. When you dine at McDonald's for breakfast, or maybe late at night and they're serving breakfast, how many hash browns do you get in addition to a sausage biscuit?
Look, there's a season in my life when I had no self-control, and I would down 4 hash browns along with my sausage biscuit. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but when they're all stacked up on top of each other...
We went golfing a month ago, and you did that when we went through a drive-thru with our dad. Don't even be like there was a season of my life. That season is your life.
The season is my life.
But every once in a while, if you get a fresh McDonald's hash brown, there's nothing better. Like when it's perfectly crispy.
That's right.
Like
it melts in your mouth, honestly. Yeah.
Maybe just a touch overdone so that you get that nice crunch when
depends
you bite into it.
Depends on the day. Right? You might want a little crunchier one. That's cool. But chef like for the most part, they mostly just like dissolve in your mouth. Mm-hmm. It's probably a testament to the type of food it is, but it just dissolves. And I could probably eat more than 4 in a sitting.
Look, it's just carbs, starches, and fried.
And salt?
Yeah.
So tasty.
You know, because we're focused on the 80s for this season, I remember being a kid going to McDonald's for breakfast and mom and dad buying the sausage biscuit, you know, getting the hot cakes with sausage, you know, that special Saturday morning that you wake up and instead of having to eat cereal in front of the cartoons, you know, they're taking you to McDonald's and that special time. And now it's like, I get to, you know, go whenever I want.
And it's also now not the 80s. So McDonald's is pretty terrible for you.
Yes.
Apparently.
It was probably pretty terrible for you back then too.
But they also now have the, what do you call them? It's the McGriddles. And there's just still no better value for your money than the hotcake breakfast.
Absolutely. The hotcakes breakfast was a good choice if you wanted some pancakes.
Yeah,
I can see you being a McMuffin kind of guy.
We're not a McMuffin kind of guy. No? I'm a chicken sandwich with cheese, or I'm a bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddle. That's what I get for breakfast at McDonald's.
Well, hey, let us know your favorite weird thing that you eat in the comments. Send an email to us. We want to know. We want to know what you eat that's weird.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I'm really excited about the story today. It's a little bit of a long one, so like strap in, hold tight. It's going to be good. Just follow with me for a little while. On the evening of July 4th, 1988, a fisherman who was just off the shore of Lake Masworthy in San Angelo, Texas, sees 2 teenagers, a young high school couple, sitting alone on the shore after enjoying the annual fireworks show over the lake. Nothing too suspicious until a pickup truck would approach them and a muffled argument with the driver would take place. 3 days later, on July 7th, both teenagers were reported missing. Who approached them in the truck, and just what were the teens involved with? Their disappearance was just more fuel thrown on a fire that burned through society during the 80s, a collective fear known as Satanic Panic. Have y'all heard that phrase before, Satanic Panic?
I haven't, no.
I have, yeah.
What is it?
satanic. Well, I mean, it ties in a lot with the Dungeons and Dragons craze that went through the 80s. Everybody was worried that it was creating, you know, a satanic cult. And it is stupid. Of course, you had a lot of serial killers. Night Stalker referenced a lot of satanic stuff, you know, in his killings as well. So I think it just, you know, the country itself is coming off of probably the biggest revival era for Christianity. And so the pendulum had to swing back the other way. And so, you know, you immediately start to think that, you know, Satanism is on the rise.
Yeah. You go from one extreme to the next.
Exactly.
Yeah. Basically in the 70s, there was because of the evangelical revival that was happening, there was just like you said, there's a pendulum that swung the other way to a fear of Satanism, basically occultism, dark magic, stuff like that. There's a big fear of it. And it almost created a mass panic and also created, you know, a lot of cases where people were either wrongfully accused. It was almost like a big witch hunt that took place in the 80s for Satanists and for occultists. Very interesting time. 18-year-old Sally McNally and 16-year-old Shane Stewart seemed to be normal teenagers growing up in San Angelo, Texas. They began dating in 1987 while in high school, and like a typical teenage relationship, were on and off again. While they were dating, though, Sally's mother, Pat, became concerned for her daughter. Sally began sneaking out late at night, and when her mom confronted her, she refused to tell her where she had been. After calling one of her friend's parents, Pat began to believe her daughter may have been involved with a satanic cult.
What was her reasoning?
Apparently, she called one of her friend's parents, one of Sally's friend's parents, and they confirmed that, I guess, their daughter had gone with her or something like that. Pat wasn't the only one concerned. Shane's father, Marshall, also noticed Shane began to change and believed he was also involved in the same cult as Sally. Shane was getting into fights with other teens, and after one of the more serious and brutal fights, Shane was thrown into a river. According to her friend Helen, Sally began regularly attending ritualistic parties where occult practices and black magic took place, and on one occasion, Helen went to one with her. It wasn't long before Helen decided to leave the party, scared and concerned for her friend's safety after Sally appeared to be in a trance during the ritual. Shane and Sally would eventually move into an apartment together in January 1988, but in March, Sally called the police claiming some members of the cult were involved in criminal activity, giving an investigator a gun that a cult member claimed was involved in a robbery murder. The gun was stolen. 6 weeks later, Sally and Shane both left town separately, fearing they'd be harmed by the members of the cult. However, by early summer, both returned to San Angelo, and in mid-June 1988, Sally told Helen they were afraid they were going to be killed.
Interesting. Anything more about who she thinks is going to kill them? I assume the cult?
Yeah, members of the cult. It sounds like a lot of the members of the cult were also teenagers that went to high school. A lot of their schoolmates, I would assume. But what I imagine is because they went to the police about this criminal activity, they probably were afraid that the cult was going to come after them, which is weird.
So this sounds like a group of kids from this high school have created this cult, kind of.
I have no details on who the members are, but I do know that a lot of them were teenagers as well. Around noon on July 3rd, 1988, Shane received a phone call that his father, Marshall, believed was about money and the cult. But Shane told him nothing was wrong. Instead, he hugged his dad and told him he was meeting up with Sally to watch the fireworks show at 9 at Lake Nasworthy, saying he'd be home by 11. Marshall never heard from Shane again. The fisherman who reported seeing the couple at the lake claimed a pickup truck approached them, and he could hear Sally tell the truck occupants that they did not want to be part of quote-unquote that anymore. But what was that? What was Sally referring to? The satanic cult? But if that's the case, then it wasn't other cult members she was talking to, was it?
I mean, if she's talking directly about the cult, then it would only make sense that the truck member, the person driving the truck, would have been involved as well.
Maybe. But there's another thought, is maybe she was trying to defend herself, saying to somebody who's not a cult member, don't hurt us because we're not part of that anymore. Now, remember, this is the time of satanic panic. So there's a good chance that there are other people in the community, maybe other teenagers, maybe other high schoolers, not involved in the cult, that are probably more Christian and a little too afraid. And maybe they were being harassed for being a part of this cult.
And so you think she was trying to, like, turn their eye away from what they're actually doing?
Possibly, yeah.
Could be.
Trying to steer them clear of, hey, we're not involved in this.
Exactly.
Yeah. At that point, you have to question, is she protecting herself or is she protecting the cult?
Probably both, if I had to guess.
Or was she being legitimate and saying, no, we're not part of that anymore. We left. We came back, but we had left, and we don't want to be part of the cult anymore.
I don't know.
The next morning, Shane's prized copper Chevy Camaro was found abandoned in a parking lot, windows rolled down, and the keys still in the ignition. Witnesses last saw the couple in the Camaro around midnight. Inside the car were food wrappers and a note from Sally to her parents, allegedly claiming she was unhappy. It would be 4 months now, November 1988, before Sally and Shane's skeletal remains would be found in a pasture 17 miles away from where they were last seen. Now, other sources claim that this was off of a farm to market road, which was generally not used by the public. So there was a good chance that it was somebody who accessed that road or didn't access that road. And so it was very, very much off the beaten path. Both had been shot in the head with a shotgun. So who killed Sally McNally and Shane Stewart? And why? Why did it take 4 months to find the remains? I think there are a couple theories that seem pretty plausible. The first one, and this comes from Marshall, Shane's father. Marshall, he mentioned a specific teen who Shane didn't really get along with. We mentioned before that Shane got into fights quite a bit, especially after being a part of this cult. Supposedly, Marshall went to the teen's home to question him, and when he came to the door, he noticed the teen had several scratches on his face, as if he'd been in a fight. He refused to speak to Marshall about the case. Dead end. Another theory suggests members of the cult that Shane and Sally were involved with determined it would be better to get rid of the couple because they went to the police. A few cult members are still considered suspects in their deaths today.
That seems more like the viable option. Trying to keep your cult or group, whatever you have, kind of a secret, or whoever's involved. You don't want any of that getting out.
Well, there's an extended theory that goes along with this that's pretty damning. In June 2017, police identified a possible suspect in this case, almost 30 years later. John Gilbreth. He was arrested for marijuana possession, and his girlfriend told officers that more drug-related evidence was at his home. But when they searched it, however, they found evidence that connected him to the Shane and Sally murders. The grisly collection included three audio tapes with SS written on them, handwritten notes and ledgers mentioning the couple, a lock of hair, a fingernail, and biological material that might be blood connected to Shane or Sally. What's more, investigators confirmed that John had been a suspect in this case from the very beginning. He was actually one of the members of the cult that Shane and Sally were part of. Now 52, he would have been 17 at the time. He had previous convictions for felony theft and delivery of marijuana. In 2018, he was convicted of marijuana and firearm possession charges and is currently serving time in federal prison. As of yet, he has not been charged with murder, but police consider him a person of interest.
So they have all this evidence.
No conviction on murder. Murder charges.
And what was the evidence that was linked to the crime or to the possible death?
He had a collection of evidence. Three audio tapes with SS written on them, where in the audio tapes their names were mentioned. Handwritten notes and ledgers mentioning the couple's names. Lock of hair, a fingernail, and biological material that might be blood that was related to Shane or Sally.
Okay, so it's fairly circumstantial evidence, but...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There's nothing that directly ties him to any crime with them. I mean, it's just all circumstantial. He could be obsessed. It could be part of what they did as the cult.
Maybe. Ooh, that's a good thought. Maybe all that biological material was part of
a ritual of some sort.
Rituals, yeah. Here we are again with circumstantial evidence. Y'all know how much I hate that.
Do we know the specific details that were in the tapes?
I do not know. But I'd like to.
Yeah, that'd be...
I'd be curious.
Because that could either, like, be damning or not.
What's most interesting to me is they said that he had been a suspect since the very beginning. Like, why wasn't there more pursued with this guy?
Yeah, I wonder what made them lean away from him initially. Enough to not even pursue anything with him. It's just kind of mind-blowing that all of a sudden this guy, who they clearly didn't search any of his possessions or his home when he was an initial person of interest, otherwise they would have found that stuff. You know, it's not like he stumbled across that years later and was like, oh, a lock of hair, ooh, a fingernail. No, he probably was in possession of this stuff from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, I guess authorities could have, if they knew some of the people that were in this cult or in this group, that maybe they just didn't want to touch it. Maybe they just wanted to stay away, and that's a product of that, is they just say, hey, we're not going to investigate this. We want to stay away from it. Because throughout everything that we've read and the stories that we found, that's a pretty common theme, is either negligence or just we don't want to touch that with police figures and authority.
Well, what about satanic panic? You see, evangelical fear of Satanism, occultism, and demonic rituals permeated the entire decade of the 80s. The fear of the occult ran rampant. Even Dungeons & Dragons was considered to be satanic. So is it possible some other group in San Angelo took it upon themselves to scare away or even hurt Shane and Sally, purposely or accidentally, for allegedly being involved with the satanic cult? I mean, that's kind of the... I feel like there's two places to, you know, two modes of thinking. Either somebody who was part of the cult did it, or somebody who wasn't part of the cult did it. And there's motivations for each side.
Yeah, to me, it would make more sense, because it sounds like the cult wasn't necessarily hurting people in the community. And so I don't see the community then going after members of the cult. I see more of, we're trying to keep secrets. We don't want everyone knowing what we're doing. And these guys are a liability.
Well, when does a cult become a negative thing?
I mean, it's got to be when either crimes or something of evil nature occurs.
Besides, like, the death cults and stuff, the ones that, you know, we all hear about the stories about the cults that, like, they all... mass suicides and stuff like that. Like, what inherently is scary about a cult? Like, why would Marshall or Pat be so worried? Or why do you think they were worried or should be worried?
I mean, I've never been part of a cult, so I can only speak in hypotheticals, but I imagine that when you're part of a cult, you lose self-determination, you adopt groupthink, and groupthink is an extremely dangerous thing because you're not thinking for yourself. You're easily coerced. You're easily convinced. I mean, that's the whole basis behind death cults, is the charismatic leader convinces these people that they need to die to, you know, ascend to the next level or whatever. And so...
I mean, there's always a element of brainwashing with cults. You get a group of people to start thinking one way about something, and that becomes their reality.
Hmm. Especially cults that are centered more around dark magic and occultism and satanic rituals, Satanism. Not always the nicest of, you know, deities to worship.
Yeah. And they also, a lot of times, look at their leader of the cult as, like, the higher power, or like the person that has come to save them. Like, that's with the group out of Crestone. Remember the the lady died, and then they kept her body for like months after she died, and she was decomposing.
Yeah, that's a There's a lot of crazy cult stories. As of 2017, this case was still open and still considered unsolved. And in a decade defined by stranger danger and a growing fear of your own neighbor, it's scary enough knowing anyone can be a suspect. But the real fear is that tomorrow, someone could decide the demonic influence is you.
Yeah.
And I think that's the scariest part of this whole satanic panic is, of course, it's scary to think that maybe people are you know, calling upon the dark forces to do bad things or to, you know, to gain whatever they want to gain from it. But it's even, I think it's even more scary that people can so quickly assume that you're the problem, even if you're not, or even if you're not doing anything wrong. And there's so much more, you know, mystery here between, like, were Shane and Sally really dark art practicers, or were they just like, did they just go to a couple parties and get in with a weird crowd? And
yeah,
because they obviously flew away from it. They tried to get away from all this.
I've also noticed, and I'm basing this off of movies and TV shows that I've seen,
of course, that's,
but they have been based off of actual events. But there's always, or usually, a handful of people who are in this cult who question things, who say, okay, is this real? Or somebody has planted a bug in their head or in their ear about, is what we're doing real? Should we be doing this? And I think that that can really scare some people in the cult. And so, like, you can't, it's hard to trust everybody when you're going through some ideology that is made up, somebody made up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, how do you fully trust that this is a real thing? And it may sound good, but I can see where there's times where people start to question.
Mm-hmm.
And when they start to question, that's when it gets dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in your story, you talked about how that they were part of a demonic cult.
They were part of a satanic cult.
A satanic, demonic.
Yeah, I see those things as kind of the same.
But actually, so like, a cult is different than the occult.
The occult refers to more like dark magic or witchcraft.
Yeah, in its most basic definition, it's the practice and use of knowledge to uncover what's been hidden.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so a cult deals more specifically with religious or semi-religious groups who are controlled by a single individual, as opposed to a cult, which is witchcraft, demonic practices,
right?
Satanism.
So in this particular instance, the cult that they were a part of was a satanic cult, where they would go to ritualistic parties where occult practices and dark black magic took place.
Interesting.
So it basically was a satanic cult, and they used occult practices within their belief. Now, that being said, it could have just been a bunch of kids getting a Ouija board out, and they and society at, you know, their community could have called that a cult.
Yeah, right? Not really knowing what they're doing. They're just kind of messing around, searching for something.
And that's where the satanic panic comes in, because when you have a group of people, so, you know, for lack of a better term, hellbent on ridding the community of any type of dark practice, and they're afraid of what that could be. Like, you have them going after kids playing a game like Dungeons and Dragons or messing with a Ouija board, and all of a sudden they're Satanists, right? And that's kind of the, on the one hand, when I read this story, I think to myself, oh, well, Sally and Shane are clearly in the wrong, because they're a part of a cult. Now, they don't deserve to die, but of course, they don't deserve to be murdered, but they probably shouldn't be part of a satanic cult either. And then it's like, well, now I have to think, were they part of a satanic cult, or were they just being teenagers messing around with stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to tell with this story. It's hard to know if if, like you said, if they were just playing a game or messing around with a Ouija board or any other object or something like that, or if they actually were worshiping Satan,
right,
or something like that.
Exactly.
I guess teenagers, though, they are very easily like molded and persuaded into do things,
mm-hmm.
and they're very curious.
Yeah, at that age, you're very impressionable, but they're also getting closer to the age of, you know, you're 16, 17, 18, where you're kind of getting out of being impressed upon so much.
Yeah, starting to make your own decisions.
Starting to make your own decisions, right. Well, I don't know. What do you all think about the whole satanic panic? Do you think it's just ridiculous? Do you think they had a point back then to have any type of fear?
I think I kind of have a feeling that the satanic panic movement, if we want to call it that, was a little kind of exaggerated, that like we were talking about kids just kind of exploring, messing around. There's nothing too serious to it, but we were coming on the other side of the pendulum from a, you know, Jesus rocks, God's amazing, far left side, and then swinging back to, you know, kids were like, they were getting turned off by the Jesus freak, you know, type, to now, what else is there?
Yeah.
Let's be a rebel.
Rock and roll was really coming in, and it was the music was in the 80s, was especially the rock music was getting more gothic.
Yeah, it was metal.
It was harder. It was louder.
I think what you see is specifically in the 80s is, you know, the 70s and 60s, it was a lot of conformism. And the 80s, really the late 70s and early into the 80s, you really saw a lot of kids just branching out and becoming individualized, which made them fringe. And people don't know what to do with people who don't conform to religious norms or whatever. And so, you know, if their music didn't fit in with what they thought, I think it really just boils down to people's perceptions of people who they deemed as outcasts,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
and it yep. sparked this nationwide panic about something that probably is not rooted in Satanism exclusively. It's not like Satanism just all of a sudden sprung up in the 80s, you know.
Yeah, they got tired of religion. They got tired of that. I mean, and that's even happening today and 10 years ago, is people are tired of the do's and don'ts when it comes to certain religions, and they don't feel like they should be tied down to, hey, I'm not allowed to dance in a church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kinds of things. I'm not allowed to have alcohol. I'm not allowed to do this. And because of that, they swing in this other side, because they want, like, I want freedom. I want to be able to do what I want. I want to be free.
Well, I love this story. I mean, you know, any unsolved mystery, especially an unsolved murder, is always interesting. But I found the backdrop of the Satanic Panic era and the Dungeons and Dragons and the metalcore time and all of that fun, those fun aspects of the 80s that we look at today and almost take for granted how it affected the society. I thought it was a very unique backdrop for the 80s.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's you know, the long hair, the kind of metal, just like culture that was kind of created in that time.
A decade of expression.
Yeah. And that even continues through the 90s and like early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
It was super popular then too.
Yeah, it would be interesting to like explore, because this is essentially it's a witch hunt, right? It'd be interesting to explore the witch hunt, quote unquote, of every like big decade. I think that'd be kind of a really fun exploration. Interesting.
What's cool about this story though too is you have a double homicide, you have a murder that has occurred, but you also have this other side that is the cult.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, it's almost two separate things that are going on. Maybe they're connected, maybe they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But it just kind of brings light to what these kids may have been going through. Maybe they were questioning things. Maybe they were trying to find answers for something. Mm-hmm. And they ended up just maybe getting to the wrong group, or whoever killed them was misunderstood of what they were doing. Yeah. You know, there's so many questions and so many different parts that play into like why they're no longer alive.
It's very chilling. There's a there's an Unsolved Mysteries episode about this specific story, this specific case. It aired in 91 with Robert Stack, of course, our favorite.
The OG.
So go check it out. Go watch the episode. It's a great story.
This episode was written by Joey Thompson with discussion from Jeremy Thompson and Brian McIntyre and was recorded at Starscream Studio. Grayson over at Starscream is an incredible producer and engineer, so be sure to visit starscreamstudio.com for all your tracking and recording needs. Additional audio support by Will Compton and original music composed by Nick McClure. Be sure to subscribe, and when you do, drop a line in the comments and say hi. We want to hear your grim stories too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.